Le Palier in Gigondas has been making a rosé that has caught my interest for several vintages now, and when I spoke recently with Daniel Brunier about it, I discovered why. Brunier is one of the owners of Le Palier, and when coming up with the plan for the rosé, he went to Domaine Tempier to discover the old recipe there. That's certainly a good place to start. Also, the Palier vineyards face northwest instead of south, and I've found that to be a common denominator among several of my favorite rosé from the warm south of France. There's a textural feel to the 2015 Palier rosé that tells me they're on to something. If you're about to stock up on rosé for summer drinking, Crush Wine and Spirits in Manhattan will offer you a discount on the 2015 Le Palier A Petit Bonheur rosé so that the price comes down to $18.99 a bottle for listeners of this show. If you want a complex rosé for under $20, this is a great way to go. Call Crush at 212-980-9463 and use the offer code IDTTFORME or use that same promo code online at crushwineco.com to make your purchase and to get your discount. You can also send me an email at levyopenswine@gmail.com. That's Levy with an I, openswine@gmail.com. If you want to join our wine club, and we'll set aside some tasty rosé specifically for you. I'll drink to that, where we get into wine one person at a time. I'm your host, Levy Dalton. The show warm-ups are provided by Aaron Scala, and together we go behind the scenes of the beverage business.
This is Troy Bowen, wine buyer at Mondo Vino, Denver, Colorado.
Colleen Holden, wine director of Eastern Standard Kitchen and Drinks in Boston, Mass.
Steve Morgan, wine director from Formentos in Chicago.
Travis Henkel, beverage director of Treadsack Restaurants in Houston, Texas.
What do all of these buyers have in common? They know that 750 is a one-stop resource for the beverage alcohol trade. Search through local distributor portfolios, see upcoming trade tastings, and easily connect with your sales rep. It's free, and it's easy to sign up. Go to 750.com for more information. One of the most impressive tasting experiences I've had in a while was sitting in to taste with Ian D'Agata during one of his certification courses for the Vinitaly International Academy. Ian is an incredible person, and his knowledge of Italian wine is really phenomenal. He has a vast understanding of the specifics of Italian wine, and he possesses one of the most impressive intellects I have met in the wine world so far. Ian helps lead the Vinitaly International Academy, which is an educational organization designed to teach future generations of teachers for Italian wine. The Vinitaly International Academy offers courses, tastings, and testing designed to prepare Italian wine experts to go out into the world with a high level of knowledge and do some teaching for themselves. I have to tell you, this is a well thought out, well done, and extensive program, and if you are seriously interested in following up your knowledge of Italian wine, there is no better opportunity out there in the world than this one. The Vinitaly International Academy is a means to better mastery of Italian wine. It is something I highly recommend participating in, and if you would like to learn more and enroll in a future certification course from the Academy, contact Via at vinitalytour.com. That's V-I-A at vinitalytour.com. If you want to really know about Italian wine, this is the best email you'll ever send. Also, the Vinitaly International Academy will be taking CVs at the Astor Center in New York on the 21st through the 23rd of June 2016 and at McCormick Place in Chicago on the 28th of June. Daniel Brunier of Vue Telegraph in Châteauneuf-du-Pape and the Southern Rhone. Hello, sir. How are you?
Good. Thank you for receiving me.
Very nice to have you here. So you got started with your dad, Henri, in about 81 at the winery.
That's right. 81 was the right year. And 2 years early, my brother started. So we can say we have started all together.
Because your dad made a new winery in 79.
Yeah, my dad built a new winery in 79. It was useful for the domain, but it was like a kind of present for his two sons arriving in the job.
And there was a big bottling of your own label in 78. That was kind of the first big year.
Yeah. In fact, it was not a big bottling. It was a kind of vintage who arrived like a bomb in our life, like a boom. It was the vintage of the 70s. Of the 80s, it's we can say it's a vintage. It's the vintage since the last 30 years, you have 78, you have 98, you have 10, maybe 07. That's the four biggest vintage we did in my professional life. So 78 was the first to be introduced in the US.
And before that, your dad had often sold to Negocia.
Yeah, a lot, a lot. In fact, the first vintages we made as a Vieux Telegraph wine was somewhere around 1910, 1915. And then during some years, the wine was sold to restaurants, to shops. And then before the war, before the Second World War, things have changed a lot. The two brothers, my grandfather and his brother, fight a lot. And it was the beginning of a hard period in the family. And my father was smart enough to rebuild everything and rebuild the Vieux Telegraph. So it started again after the war, and somewhere before 1950, he was like 20 years old. And he rebuilt the vineyard, but he spent his life to rebuild the vineyard and forgot the bottling, forgot the marketing. So he built the vineyard, make wines, and then sold the wine in bulk to negotiate. That was the easiest way to make money, I mean short
turnaround. You gave turnaround, it quickly.
And then built his things, built the vineyard. And then he did this until 1970, so during a big part of his life. And then around 1970, he restart to bottle the wines, just because we were around, we were talking about working with him, etc., etc. And then in 1978, that was really the first vintage to promote, to market, really outside of France.
So he really started the winery seriously because of you guys, instead of selling to Negos. He knew there was another generation.
Exactly, exactly. He just started another philosophy, another life for the company because of us. The vineyard was designated by my great-great-great-grandfather, Henri, 1891. He first bought land on La Croix, where I live today, to begin to buy. It was wood everywhere, wood and olive trees.
Oh, it wasn't a lot of vines back then?
No, small, very small part was vine.
Because now there's so many old vines there. I mean, people talk about 60, 100-year-old.
Oh, yeah, but it was after him. And then he bought this land just to give to his son, which was Hippolyte. And we say in the family, Hippolyte began the business, but really speaking, it's Henri who began the business, the generation before, just because he has the idea to buy the land. So we don't know, during years and years, we have no him in our history because he was not a winemaker, but he was at the beginning. That's something. So he bought the land, the first land, and then Hippolyte began to plant vines with his son, Jules, Jules, and Jules was my grandfather. So we began to grow in this La Croix place. So Jules built a house, built a winery in La Croix, continued to buy the land with his father, and extend the vineyard until about 20 hectares around my home. And my father took over this 20 hectares, the house, of course, and then extended to 50 hectares around the house. And that was his life, to extend from wood, not in buying vines. That's another job. It means changing wood to vine. It's a long process.
Moving it from forest to vineyard.
Yeah.
So what was the history of the area? I mean, was it an area that had been cultivated to vine?
The first vine arrived on La Croix in the 14th century. 1-4. 14th century. When the Pope arrived in Châteauneuf-du-Pape, they were very pushy in the wine demand. Of course, the white wine arrived at this time, just because they needed white wine for the mass.
Oh, for the mass, yeah,
for
sure.
The mass. And of course, they push they ask for wine because they already know that the wine from Château du Pape has something different than the wine from other places around. So in Lacroix, we know that vines are planted since the 14th century, but in very, very small places. It was like coming from the center of the village, extending and planting some. Because Lacroix, as his name says, it's a very stony place. Croix coming from rock, and Croix coming from windy and difficult place to grow, dry place to grow. It's very, very stony, as you know, and it's very difficult to grow. So Lacroix was not the first place where people think about growing, because it was horses doing the job at this time, so it was everything was by hand. 70% of stones from 0 to 4 meters underground, so it's quite a big deal. So to grow there,
and the whole vineyard is about 200 hectare Lacroix, the whole area.
Yeah, yeah, the whole area is about 200 hectares. So it's a huge plateau. It's a huge plateau, and it's like a kind of let's say big plateau at 128 meters above the sea level, and divided it by three different villages in terms of administration. We are in the Bédarrides section, the southeast section. And I think, the biggest name place in terms of size in Châteauneuf, because it's the same terroir on Lacroix Place, on Lacroix Plateau, from the east to the west, from north to south, it's the same terroir. It's like a single vineyard of 200 hectares.
So that terroir is glacial rounded stones.
Yeah.
And then what's that on top of?
So we have the stones. That means when it's natural soil, you see the stones, but you see hearse. When it's cultivated, you don't see hearse at all. Because when you plow, you move the stones. Stones come up, the hearse come down, and the rain clean the stones. And then you see only stones. And on today, on the plateau, it's 100% cultivated. You see only stones on 20 centimeters. So it's really, really stony. It's like a small round breads, yellow and brown, big or smaller on the surface. And then underneath, you have this kind of 1 meter of hearse, cultivated hearse, where the roots can live and can find their food. About 80% of the roots are in that layer. That means close to get the rain, easy to cross, it's not clay. But in that kind of layer, we have about 70% of stones. 70% of stone. It's huge. And then underground, we reach the clay, the big red, and underground, the orange clay, with also in between 70% of stones. The water goes through the first layer and stays on the clay. That means we have from the soil about 2 meters underground, we have about 1 year of reserve of water.
Must be helpful in drought years.
Oh, yeah.
Like 81, that was your first, that was a drought year, right?
Like 81, like 99, like 96, like 2006, like 2003. So we are in the south of France, don't forget it. And it's forbidden to irrigate. Of course, we do not irrigate. We cannot call a terroir if it's irrigated or drained.
In a way, it's the stones that made the area famous, but it may also be the water retention that made the area famous.
Of course, of course.
That's interesting.
Yeah, and the wind. Without wind, no Châteauneuf du Pape.
The Mistral is very strong.
Mistral is 200 days a year, and it makes the things. It makes things. When you taste Vieux Télégraphe, you taste the wind. I mean, the lightness, it's kind of hairy things, kind of... it's kind of, you go through the wine and you can see through the wine. It means the color is not dark. The color is not black. And I'm convinced it's like if you can taste the wind through the wines.
And practically, it probably means that there's less disease pressure. If you're getting a lot of strong wind, it probably means there's less rot pressure.
That's why I tell you, without wind, there is no Châteauneuf du Pape, because it's hot. The grapes, Grenache, it's so sensitive to humidity. Sometimes we receive 100 millimeters of water in 2 hours, which is a storm it's a tornado for some countries. For us, it's normal. It's Provence. It's very, very aggressive. You have this kind of sunshine, very hot, the wind very hard. Rain is very fast and very wide and strong. And then 2 hours, not 2 days, 2 hours later, it's blue sky, dry air, and because of the wind, because the Mistral blows and then clean everything in the region, and then everything disappears. That means you have, in 2 hours later, you have no sign of water on the street, no sign of water on everywhere, because it's so dry, it could be 20% of humidity in the air when it blows. So it's like a vacuum cleaner for the water. It's incredible. So it changes the dramatically the climate. It makes the climate.
So you're in the southeast of the Châteauneuf du Pape appellation.
Mm.
And you, at this point, because you purchased another estate, La Roquette, you have parcels in other parts of the Châteauneuf appellation, some of which are kind of famous parcels, like Pignan and Colombis.
Yeah, and Piedon.
So if I were to think of those things as different and try to understand how those vineyards are different, I know the major holding for you is La Croix. But if you were to compare it to those other parcels, how do they differ in the Châteauneuf zone?
When we bought La Roquette in 1986, we went to this place and then let's see what speaks, how the soil speaks. And we did the same thing as we do at Vieux-Télégraphe. We do the same winemaking process, no intervention, some non-destimming process, long maceration, long aging process, etc., etc. And the result was so different than La Croix. We say, why not? So it helped us to make different wines. But we never, never obtain a result as we were expected. Always a bit frustrated. When you're born on La Croix and you get out of La Croix, you are frustrated. I'm sorry, I have to tell you.
Here you are in New York, pissed.
No, you are frustrated because it's like if you eat to Jean-Georges every day. I mean, it's difficult to eat outside after. So
you think La Croix is the prized place? Is that what that analogy
means? You know, it's not, you know, I know about 10 domaines in Châteauneuf du Pape who created their top cuvée on La Croix.
Right. I mean, there's famous examples.
Yeah. And famous examples. So I don't want to say names on this microphone, but, you know, I know about 10, minimum 10. It's not because of nothing. It's because something happens on La Croix. It's like this. It's not myself. It's really people realize that. So today we found another name place which has a great personality called Piedon. It's another plateau, a bit higher than La Croix, but 2 or 3 meters higher than La Croix. It's 130 meters. It's the highest point in Châteauneuf du Pape, Point Culminant. And we have this, we bought it here in 1986, 10 hectares of very old Grenache. We still have the same 10 hectares of old Grenache. And we make a wine called Piedon with this single vineyard since 2011. So it's new for us. But during years and years and years, we were frustrating by the result. Now we say, okay, let's try the result of 100% of another plateau. And we did it. By chance, we have done a lot of experimentation before just to arrive to this decision. But today we have our telegram, which is the blend of different soil, which are maybe less character, less personality. And then we have two single vineyards, Piélon and Lacroix, and we cannot get out of this. It's something which speaks too loud. And for us, it's what we like.
So how do you find the approachability when you drink Piélon and Lacroix as young wines?
They have the same kind of saltiness, the same sapidity, the same savory, and the same lightness. Piélon is more accessible young. Lacroix is a bit more rustic, and the good side of the term, a bit more rich. I don't know why, but it's a bit more rich, a bit more rustic, a bit more something. So if you meet a woman and a man together, the same size, the same personality, the same beauty, but it's a woman and a man, they are different.
Well, here's a question for you. You have a lot of claret, and sometimes it's in white wines and sometimes it's in red wines that you make. You have other white grape varieties, and then you have a handful of red grape varieties, some of which you already mentioned, like Grenache, Syrah, Mourvèdre, Cinsault. If Lacroix is the same terroir, if it's a uniform terroir, how do you decide which plant goes where?
We don't. I mean, when we arrive with my brother, Frédéric, we had already a great heritage of old vines. And among these old vines, on Lacroix, just on top of Lacroix, about kind of small hectare of claret, which were 85 years old at this time. So now they are more than 100 years old.
You still have those?
Oh, sure.
That's awesome.
Oh, sure.
Is there something else like that around?
Yeah,
I mean, that doesn't seem common.
That's heritage. Vieux Télégraphe at the very beginning was 100% claret. That's really the origin of Vieux Télégraphe, white. So, and we vinify, of course, separately. And it's always a kind of example of freshness, of saltiness, of finesse, a bit too light sometimes. So we said, why look for another terroir to plant white grapes? Why don't we just plant white if we need to have more white for the future on this Lacroix place and forget this kind of things which are specialized on white and specialized on red? So now, today, we have on Lacroix the red and the white all together. And the freshness which is in our red, it's the same freshness which is in our white, but they are in the same philosophy. But no, there is no, we don't look for a special place for white.
Are they interplanted, the vines, or are they in blocks?
Oh, well, I was talking about the specific white to make white Vieux Télégraphe. But in the old vines, we have this percentage of white claret which are interplanted since the real beginning. And I really think it was a mistake at the real beginning. It was a mistake just because, I don't know, but I have this feeling, I cannot imagine they planted this claret among the Grenache just because they had in mind to do something. They had no trouble of global warming at this time. They had no trouble of things like that. It was much more rustic as an approach to the wine. So it was certainly a mistake. And then in year after year, it became something interesting, which bring this kind of finesse, kind of anise, kind of white flower taste, kind of equilibrium. And also today, a kind of balance to reduce the alcohol content because the claret is ripe at the same time as the Grenache red at 13% of alcohol or 12.5. It's ripe, very ripe. instead, the comparatively, the Grenache is ripe at 15% of alcohol, but at the same time. So when you blend them, it's a kind of natural reduction of alcohol content. And it works during the winemaking process because when they are co-fermented, they do well in terms of complexity, in terms of finesse, in terms of color. It's not a problem.
Do you find that when you have a parcel or a block that's interplanted, that the ripening curve for a grape variety is different than when it's planted by itself? Does it ripen together in the interplanted block as opposed to Grenache or Mourvèdre by itself?
No. No, they ripe the same thing. Something is different. It's when they are young. When they are very young, the young and interplanted vines are doing far better than 100% of new vines in another field. It's because they have the concurrence of the old one, and they grow slowly. They grow with concurrence. Which is not the case in a new vineyard. In a new vineyard, they have much more strength and they produce more grapes, more bigger grapes than they produce at the same age, surrounded by old vines, surrounded by roots.
So when I look at the pictures of Le Crau, I haven't been there. I apologize. When I look at the pictures, and I can't tell if I'm looking at everything or just a piece of it, but it seems like the spacing is pretty wide.
Yeah, you're right. Don't forget, we are in a dry climate. We are in a place where I do not irrigate. I don't have to recall you that for us, no irrigation means terroir. That means if you irrigate, it's not terroir. It's a piece of land where you grow something. So no irrigation, dry climate, bush pruning, goblet pruning.
Has to be, right?
Yeah, it has to be by law for the Grenache, for the Mourvèdre, for the Cinsault. It has to be like this. So we need room for the leaves. We need room for the tractors. We need room to cross the things, to cross in terms of plowing, just because we do an organic growing and we like to cross. And we need room because of the competition in terms of soil, in terms of surface on the soil, because of the water, because the vines needs water. If they are too close together, they compete. So there is a big philosophy in our region too, that more you have feet on a hectare, more you make quality. Honestly, I don't think it works in our region. It's good for Burgundy, it's good for Bordeaux, it's good for the humid regions because they have water and they have to compete. They have to compete. If there is no competition, there is no quality. But all vines compete against nature, against sunshine, against wind, against humidity, not against vines. So that's really, it's another word. And when I see in the south of France, every vine planted every meter, I'm a bit confused because a real goblet is 1 meter size of diameter after 8 years old. It's minimum 1 meter of diameter after 8 years old. So if you plant every 1 meter, that means you just give to your goblet 50 centimeters of development. So it's frustrating. And you don't have hair. There is no way where the Mistral can turn around, can dry your things, and can be helpful for the grapes.
So what about the differences between white and red in the soil? When you work with Claret, Beau Blanc, Roussan, versus working with Syrah, Cinsault, Mourvèdre?
There is no difference. Not at all. The only difference we can have is in terms of maturity process, but in terms of maintaining against mildew, against oidium, against cochilis, oedemis, it's the same. It's the same. But of course, maturity process is different. Roussan and Grenache Blanc arrive very early. They have a very early maturing. And then the Clairette and Bourbolenc arrive late. So we generally pick the Haussan and the Grenache first. And then we wait some days to, and sometimes some weeks to pick the Clairette and the Bourbolenc, which are late maturing.
Clairette seems like somewhat of an extraordinary grape, the way that it can be that low in alcohol and that high in acidity mature late. That seems unusual.
Yeah, it's incredible. Yeah. I told you they arrive with the full Grenache season arrives. And that's really funny because we begin by Sensot, we begin by the Grenache Blanc, the Roussanne, that's really the beginning. It's one day, and then we stop, and another day, and da-da-da-da. It's really like we are looking where we go, checking if the maturity has really arrived, and then you have everything arriving together. That means the full Grenache mature in the same time. Don't forget, we are in the same terroir. We are in the same name place. They all arrive in the same time. And the Clairette arrive at this time. And it's really funny. That's why it's nice to do a co-fermentation with Clairette and Grenache.
You prefer to do co-ferments pretty much
across the board. We love to do co-fermentation. Of course, the pure Grenache is great. Pure Grenache is... it's really our blood. I mean, when we ferment a pure 80 years old Grenache from La Croix, it's more than a pleasure. It's something, it's fantastic every year. It's really the essence and the DNA of the vintage. And as soon as we have the result of this tank and we have the signature of the vintage.
You think that the Grenache shows the year?
Of course.
And the other grape varieties maybe show the grape variety?
Yeah. Yes, I think so. Yeah. It's a bit quick as a comment, but I'm convinced it's reality. Yeah. Grenache is not a cannibal of terroir. It's really Grenache push the terroir in front of you, in front of your face. If you have a simple terroir, it will tell you you have a very simple terroir. I cannot make only fruit in your place. If you have a complex, historic, deep, and stony, and windy, and dry, and it's with all Grenache, it will tell you, yes, I can do sexy, elegant, and rich Grenache. And that's the only way to do a Grenache which has this kind of personality.
But Grenache gets pretty ripe pretty quick there during the harvest season, right? I mean, it probably can go through different elevated sugar levels.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really... really strange because the Grenache is very, let's say, flexible in terms of maturity. Very helpful. You can trust these grapes. You can be not really good. I mean, if you know what I mean, you can arrive from vacation a bit late and the Grenache will be there waiting for you. And that's great. It's not what we do, but it's what we think. Because the Grenache can be picked in over maturation and it will be good. And if the climate permits it. But it's really the Grenache. The Grenache it does not support the, comment dit, the sous-maturité, the under's maturity.
Doesn't get underripe. Doesn't get
It doesn't support the underripeness. The Grenache is no good when it's not ripe, but the Grenache is good when it's overripe. Of course, it's good when it's ripe, but it's good when it's also overripe. And it's really strange because the Grenache get to be ripe, and then you taste it, and it's good, and you have the skin like this, and the maturity is achieved, and you have the good. Level of sugar, and you have the pips which are ripe, and you have everything, but in your filling, you say, ah, wait another 1, 2, 3 days because the mistral is blowing. And then the skin becomes a bit like dry by the mistral.
A little shriveled.
Yes, like olives, you know?
And maybe a little loose.
Yeah, and you lose juice, you lose fruit, you lose liquid, and it's what we call the overripeness. And it's good because it brings you taste, which is impossible to get in the ripe time. And it's not ripeness, it's concentration. It's ripeness, but not physiologic.
It's a texture thing.
Yeah, it's a texture. You get the ripeness physiologically, and then you lose juice by the wind, by the dryness of the climate. That's more like concentration, natural concentration. And it's good, but people tend to use too much this to build big wines, to build kind of fruit bomb and concentrated zinc, which has its kind of default. But we have to get to this period to be good, but not to exaggerate, to lose the finesse and the freshness.
How do you handle that Grenache fruit versus the earlier picked Grenache fruit? Is there any difference with what you do with them in the winery?
Oh, we don't early pick the Grenache.
I mean, that was the wrong term. How do you handle that picked fruit of Grenache versus the Grenache that's ripe at the normal way?
You're right. Sometimes we pick Grenache at a normal maturity. Normal means ripe, not overripe. And generally speaking, it's mainly terroirs which have lower personality, or young vines, or things like this. And in order to create our telegram, so we have another, of course, we have another demand on in our heads to make this wine. The idea is to create a wine which is representative of the appellation with good balance, good fruit, good Grenache taste. But we know that complexity we got for the Vieux Télégraphe, it's impossible to get in the Telegram. So,
which is a different bottling you make and sell for less money.
Yeah, of course. It's not for the same bottling, and that's really from the real beginning. We know exactly the vineyard in our domain. We own about 95, 96, 97 hectares in Châteauneuf-du-Pape, red and white. And we know exactly what hectare is capable to be in the Vieux Télégraphe from Lacroix or not, from the real beginning. That means when we are ready to pick the grapes, we know exactly what will be the result. Sometimes we have a surprise, positive, negative. Sometimes we have to declassify a tank from Vieux Télégraphe to Telegram. Sometimes we are very happy with young vines, so you never know. But 90% of the time, you know exactly what will be the result of the different parcels.
So sometimes you destem red fruit and sometimes you don't. And what's the decision making there? I mean, why do you choose?
First of all, the non-destemming, that means the fact to keep the stems in the winemaking process, but crushing the grapes. So the non-destemming is used with old vines, Grenache, old vines, that's it. That's the first element.
You keep the stems on old vines?
Yeah, we keep the stems on old Grenache. And then every year it's a challenge. Every year it's a challenge what piece of land on Lacroix will be not or this stem. And it's an analysis of every day. We are in the vineyard during the harvest, of course, and we say, okay, this piece of land can be destemmed or have to be destemmed because of the color of the stems, or this part can be great without destemming because of the color of the stems, because of a lot of things. So it's really, really a daily decision. We cannot say this vintage we will destem 30% or not. No, it's just every day, we decide. And it could be at the end of the vintage to have 30%, 20%, 10%. In 2003, we were afraid by this kind of dryness, kind of no rain from April to September. We are very afraid by the tannin structure. So we did 100% destemming, just because we were afraid in advance by the tannins. So it's really dependent on the vintage.
Do you sense more of the soil type of Lacroix in the parcels that are destemmed or the parcels that are not destemmed? Do you get more soil signatures either way?
Yeah, of course, yes. Oh, yeah. I know that's, I would like to say yes, that's it.
Okay.
But I can't. I have to explain. But yes, of course, when you done this stem from a place like Lacroix, let's say 80 to 100 years, Grenache, you have your skin which moves. It's something you feel in your blood. It's a wind in the wine. It's you feel the stones, you feel the hair, you feel the kind of hairy things, lightness. You lose the color. That's a default. But there is nothing comparable. Nothing comparable. And you lose the fruits, which is good. I mean, for me, for us.
Because you get a lot of fruit already.
No, from because we don't like fruit. Fruit is boring. Honestly, everyone can make fruit on this planet. You can make fruit on this top of this building with vines. It's easy. Make saltiness, make rockiness, make smokiness, make this kind of default, which is for us quality. It's not so easy.
Do you feel that over the time that you've been there since 81 that you've used more or less Mourvèdre or more or less Cinsault?
Oh, more Mourvèdre. From the real beginning, we have planted Mourvèdre. In the 80s, we began to plant Mourvèdre with my brother, and we are just enjoying now, after 30 years. Vieux Télégraphe, it's a bit more from Mourvèdre grape, a bit less Grenache. Still the same proportion of Syrah. Syrah, it's interesting in the south of France. Difficult to manage because it brings kind of heavy fruit, heavy things. Not very fine, not very elegant. So we don't like more than 10-15% in our blend. But Mourvèdre is not the same. Mourvèdre can be very interesting. So we have this proportion Mourvèdre increasing in our wines.
Do you feel that there's been a learning curve there over the years? Have you learned things about Mourvèdre that have been sort of surprising to you?
No. No, honestly, from the real beginning, we arrived and we decided we have not enough Mourvèdre. It was only 10% at this time, and now we have grown to somewhere around 18%, 15 to 18, it's depending on the year. So it's we think it's far better.
And not much since so, really.
Yes, we have somewhere around 4-5% of Cinsault. But Cinsault, it's nice. Cinsault is difficult. Cinsault needs, like the Grenache, be old. Cinsault needs great soil, needs dryness, needs small yields, needs... wind. It's very, very sensitive to moisture, so it's difficult.
It's finicky.
Yeah. But we still have some Cinsault, and we keep some Cinsault, 3-4%. But it's difficult to manage.
How are the mallows? Do they tend to go long, or are they short mallows?
No.
Short.
No, it's easy. We don't use any sulfur during the winemaking process. It's such small dose when you arrive at the end of the of the fermentation, alcoholic fermentation, we have zero. So the malolactic goes easily. Sometime they are a bit blocked by the alcohol content, sometime, but it's quite rare. It could be 15, could be 15.5, and malolactic is, they are very, very adapted to this level of alcohol. And generally speaking, arriving middle of December, everything is done. So we can turn off the cleam, let the fresh air coming in the cellars and begin the kind of first winter interfering, which is good, which is necessary to clean the wines naturally in the winery. If we begin by the beginning, fermentation about, let's say, 30 to 40 days, fermentation and maceration together. Then we separate the fruit juice from the berries, which are fermented, of course, and they represent, and the juice, which is still at this time in the berries, represent about 25% of the volume, the total volume. So it's important. So we press, pneumatic press, no more than 1.6 bar. And then we blend directly the fruit juice or the pressed juice with the fruit juice.
That's interesting because it seems so harmonious. Like it.
Oh, yeah. Wait. Honestly, fruit juice by itself, it's like something is lacking. Pressed juice by itself, if like it's too rude, too tannic, too rustic, and together it's much more interesting in terms of analysis, in terms of tasting, in terms of color, in terms of aging potential. So sometimes we have to be careful because in some press wine, we could have a residual sugar. So we have to weigh the residual sugar as finished to ferment and to be transformed. But the result is that we blend. At the end, we blend the fruit juice and the pressed juice. And we made experimentation with fruit juice by itself. It's never a good result. For us, it's too a lack of personality, a lack of presence. So we like to be blended. But it's possible only if the pressing is very, very careful. Because don't forget, we still have the stems. So that means we have to carry the grapes by hand from the tank to the press. That means it's the press rolling in front of the tank. No tube, no pump, no screw. That's our law for reception of the grapes, the fresh grapes. And at the end of fermentation, same rule. No screw, no pump, no tube. Only by hand, rolling carpet, vibration. That's a leitmotiv in our family.
That might be a big part of the finesse, you know, not pumping.
Honestly, I think so. Yeah, I think so. But it's, you never know. That's the chance of this business. You never know what does what. If it God made the vintage, or if it's you who made the vintage, you never know that.
One of the other things that you do is you have a mixture of steel, foudre, cement. And so I feel like that texturally adds more complexity, and the fact that in different stages you're...
It's what we think. We don't like pure wineries. We like hybrid wineries. Just because, for example, a Grenache from Lacroix, 20 years old, will maybe not be interesting in wooden tank. Maybe more interesting in stainless steel tank, because stainless steel, it's known, give more tannins, more freshness, more rusticity. An old, 80 years old Grenache from Lacroix, who doesn't need anything to add tannins or finesse or complexity, will be better in wood, just because the wood tends to to soft the tannins, to bring this kind of complexity of tannins, of the length of the tannins, the finesse of the tannins, etc. And in wood, the maceration can be very long. In stainless steel, it's a bit more difficult to do a long, long maceration. Same thing if we go to Palière.
Which is your Gigondas property.
Yeah, Palière, it's our Gigondas winery. We don't have the same result. In Palière, we have wood and cement for fermentation, which is another hybridization of the vinification. We like to be hybrid just because the world is not black or white.
So you had Old Vine Grenache in Le Crau from the beginning, and then in 98, you and Kermit Lynch and your brother purchased La Palière in Gigondas, and that has Old Vine Grenache. So what's it been like sourcing Old Vine Grenache from two very different terroirs in the Southern Rhone? I mean, what's the expression of a Grenache and how does it differ?
Let's say that was a big question at the beginning, and we arrive in Gigondas with our Chateau Neuf du Pape rules, which is something, but not everything. That means we thought that the Grenache needs to be vinifying like this, 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 and this, and we try to apply these rules to Gigondas. But in the same time, we knew that the tannins concept is very different in Gigondas and Chateau Neuf du Pape, and we were a bit difficult to begin. So we begin, and quickly we learned that tannin were very, very difficult to manage in Gigondas. So first of all, the date of harvest in Gigondas is much more, it has to be much more precise than Chateau Neuf. Chateau Neuf is much more flexible in terms of harvest time. You never will have dry and difficult and rude tannin in Chateau Neuf. They are always soft, always good feeling. In Gigondas, they can be very rude. So Gigondas, date of harvest is very important. Non-distimming in Gigondas bring very interesting things, but it has to be done very, very carefully. So the result today is we know that the Grenache in Gigondas has this kind of density, this kind of color, this kind of density, natural density, which is really from the soil, from the exposition, from the northwest exposure, from the altitude, which is his own character. And the Grenache, about 20 kilometers west from Gigondas, which where we have La Croix, gives this kind of overripe, kind of marmalade taste, kind of overripe strawberry taste, which is impossible to get in Gigondas.
You don't get that compote taste.
No.
It tastes brighter somehow, even though it has a darker color.
Exactly. Much more brighter, much more like cherry, not much more like black things. If we have to design a Gigondas, it will be more on the black side of the picture. And Vieux Télégraphe in Chateau Neuf, Grenache will be more like a lovely red, but not as black. So in terms of fruit, in terms of sensation of fruit, in terms of aroma, it's black and red. It's very different, very different. Same age, same grape, same vinification process. We have this kind of big difference, which is from the austerity of the soil in Gigondas and the warm plateau in Chateau Neuf. They don't give the same thing.
And you get like limestone off the dentils in the Gigondas, right?
Yeah, it's about 30% of kind of piece of rocks coming from the mountain, which are blend to the clay, to the sand, to all this blend of earth. And it's like a kind of millefeuille of limestone rocks. And it's not stone, it's rocks, white. They have the same role than the stones have in Châteauneuf-du-Pape. That means keep the moisture, keep this kind of complexity, because they are obstacles to the roots. Roots need obstacles to be down, to be deeper. If the roots have no obstacles, they just go straight like in a highway, and there is no taste in a highway. So the stones, rocks, make the road more than back roads, and the roots turn around and take the taste on the stones and on the rocks. That's my feeling. It's not technical analysis. It's my feeling.
So you make two red wine bottlings at the Gigondas property.
Yeah.
Racine and Terrasse de Diab.
Yes.
One is on terraces and one is closer to the winery. How do those two terroirs differ for you?
As you say, it's a problem of altitude. During years, we vinify all together. We made only one wine. And we decided to separate in 2007. The vineyard, which is around the winery, somewhere around 250 meters in altitude. We separate it from the vineyard, which is over in the altitude in the mountain, from 300 to 400. And that was a decision which was made by, after some years of tasting, the fruit was different, the structure was different. Much more fruit in altitude, much more heaviness, much more roundness, much more suppleness and depth around the house. And we say, why don't we make two wines? We say, yes, okay. And the last vintage we did together, the two last vintages, the three last vintages, we had some trouble in terms of tannins. Tannins were a bit dry, a bit aggressive. And we didn't know how to integrate the tannins. It was not a problem of maturity process. It was not a problem of distilling, of things. It was a big, big, big challenge for us. And as soon as we have separated the two terroirs, we have had no more trouble of tannins. It's incredible. It was unexpected. I think the two terroirs competed, and there was something happened in that competition which was realized and which was described by the tannins. We arrived from Châteauneuf-du-Pape, from La Croix, this plateau. More you blend, more you gain in terms of complexity.
Right.
That was in our spirit. And we say, let's do blending. But if it's not the same origin, if it's not really the same origin, more you blend, more you take risk. So that's the first lesson of Palier. And now we know that blending was for us natural, but it's not at all. So from 2007, we began to do this two separated cuvées. We had no problem of tannins, and we met big vintages, average vintages, dry climate, wet climate since 10 years now. So it's not 10, but 8 years. So somewhere it was a great, great lesson.
Was there an exposition difference?
Exposition, no. All our domain is facing north and west.
That's kind of amazing for a red wine.
100%.
You know what I mean?
That it yeah.
Faces north.
But don't forget, we are in the south of France. So we can do it, and it works because we are in the south of France. Some vineyard of Palier got the sunlight around 10:30 during the harvest time. It's late to get sunshine. So that was for us a big deal. So we had to wait and wait and wait and wait, which is comfortable for us because we begin the harvest. We have the Vieux Télégraphe white, and then we have the red Vieux Télégraphe. We have the Grenache, and then we go to Piolon, and then we go in Caron, Ventoux, and then we've Palier arrived.
Also, it's the latest.
Yeah, of course. Palier arrived at the rear end. Vantu is harvested. Everything is harvested when Palia arrives.
Did you realize when in 98 that climate change was happening when you made the purchase?
No.
Just got lucky.
Yeah.
I mean, because it sounds like you got lucky then, because you're facing north in an area of climate change.
Yeah. Honestly, we didn't do this analysis, and we are very lucky, just because it's a personality of the place. It could be with or without the climate change. I mean, the personality of the place is to make fine wine, because of the length of the maturity process, because of the soil, because of the sunlight, etc. So it's really specific. It's really a kind of microclimate.
So that's the only property where you make a rosé.
Yeah.
And there must be a reason. there must be some logic there that's the only place you decided to do it.
Yeah. First of all, it's forbidden in Châteauneuf-du-Pape to make rosé. But it's not the reason. The reason is, when we bought the place, we have bought, of course, this 25 hectares. Among them, about 10-12% was white grape. But some of them were not great. And some of them were great, really great old Clairette. And if you remember, we are fan of very old Clairette. So we cannot say, oh, yeah, just changes old Clairette in young Grenache. So that was not our feeling. And we say, okay, we added to the Grenache and to the Grenache tanks to do a co-fermentation, etc. But it was a bit too much. And then one day I say to my partners, who are Kermit Lynch and my brother, why don't we try to make a rosé, and we can use this proportion of white and also use the grapes which are in the mountain, a bit too much in the shadow, with not a big maturation process. Every year we had a tank, a red wine tank, which were a bit like, not the poor tank, but kind of baby in the winery. We didn't know if we wanted to keep it or to sell in bulk. It was every year we had this kind of question. So I told to them, why don't we try to make this parcels a rosé, and then use a part of the white? And they say, well, why not? So we did an experimentation, and at the same time we experiment a very old fashioned way to make rosé, because we could not compete against this world of rosé, which is too technical. I don't know how to make a technical wine. Honestly, I have to be back on books or to ask to someone to help me. So it was a big question. So the easiest way were to do the wine by feeling. And that's why we call it Petit Bonheur, Les Palières. That means make by feeling, not made by technicals. So I went to see Daniel Ravier in Tampier, in Bandol, and I asked him what was the recipe of Mr. Pierrot during his last vinification process. And he told me, nothing, just pick the grapes, vinified in wood, make the Malo, do the bottling, boom. Why don't try this? And I say, we can try something at the complete opposite of what they do in the rosé area. So no selected yeast, only native yeast, 100% vinified in wood, no temperature control, malolactic is done, age on lees, bottled. That's it. And it works. So, and of course, we make a wine which has a personality of the terroir and not of the yeast, not of the labo. It has a real personality of what we like to show it's our terroir. And also we use now the vines which are in a place where maturity was not so easy to get every year. And we use 30% of of the white to make the rosé, and the other white goes into the Grenache tank to be kind of balance for the alcohol content. That's the way we manage the white at Palière.
Palière, the estate, a lot of it is forested.
Oh yeah, it's about 120 hectares of forest.
So is that very different than working in Châteauneuf-du-Pape? I mean, is there an influence from the forest nearby?
A lot. A lot of influence in terms of neighborhood. We have no vine neighbor, only wood. That means we are in a position of disease, which is quite comfortable. And also we have this kind of environment of humidity, of climate, of a lot of things. And then we have decided to use this wood to build a goat cheese business. That means goat cheese business. Business is not really the term I could use because it's just artisan things. But we have now 45 goats from Phoenicia, which is called Rove, R-O-V-E. It's a nice goat coming from the other side of the Mediterranean to Marseille and then to Gigondas. And we make goat cheese and to enjoy the woods, to use the woods for creating something more than environment something. It's a creation of product, and the goat cheese has a taste of the place. Because, of course, the goats come into the wood a bit, let's say, half a 50% of their time. And then it's kind of good balance. The wood brings a lot to the wines, of course, and to the vines.
And you know what goes well with a good goat cheese? It's a good claret white wine from Châteauneuf-du-Pape, I bet.
That's right.
I'm just guessing, but...
Yeah.
So about that white, what's the story with that? I've only had it young. Does it age particularly well? Does it go through phases? And what's the style with that?
It really depends on the vintages. But if we take, let's take a great vintage, 2014, which is for me a great vintage in white in Châteauneuf-du-Pape, just because of the finesse, richness, kind of classic, a bit sharp. The aging process is generally like this. First year, after bottling, prime of fruit, bit rude, some tannins, white flower, kind of bitterness, anise. Then arrive the second and the third year and the fourth year. And it's in that generally age we are selling them. A bit more complex honey taste arrive. They lose a bit their primer fruit. They get some complexity, a bit more adapted for food, etc. Well, that's a good period for us, and it's where we sell the wine. For example, in New York, we have the 2013 to sell today, and it's enter in a very good period. And then this period can run during, let's say, 4 or 5 years. And then it can be very, very frustrating after, let's say, arriving around the 7, 8 anniversary. The wine can fall down in a dumb period very seriously. It can be like kind of Riesling with oily taste and kind of rude. And reduce nose, which is not very comfortable, not very a bit disturbing.
It smells like gasoline, like petrol.
It smells like gasoline. Yeah, and then this period finished after, let's say, at the age of 10, 12, and then a second life arrives, and then you have this kind of freshness and finesse. Of course, the aromas are different, mainly like. Kind of, they are very similar to Burgundian wine at this age, in terms of aging. And at this time, they can age. They can age as well as the reds. As well. Not every vintage. But the great vintage of white, they age as well as the red in at Via Telegraph. they can age 30 years. They can age 20, they can age 15. It's if we open today at 93, 92, 1990, I'm convinced it will be, they will be interesting.
Because I don't know a lot of white wines in the world that age like that. That's a...
Yeah, of course you have all the Grey Burgundies, you have Hermitage white, which age like this.
But with that curve, that yeah, up and down. Yeah. You know,
Hermitage has this kind of curve. It's the only wine I know it has this kind of curve. And of course, and the Riesling are a bit like this too.
Sure. That's true. Yeah, that's very true, yeah. Actually. Does it have anything to do with lees? I mean, what do you do with...
Oh.
Nothing.
No.
Do you have much lees contact on the white?
Of course.
You extended.
Of course. Oh, yeah. Vinification is very simple. As I told you with the rosé, it's exactly the same. Just direct pressing. Very... very light pressure, and then in wood for months or two in terms of fermentation. The fermentation starts native yeast, and then fermentation, no temperature control, nothing. And then we ferment during a month and age only until the beginning of the winter, January, February. At this time, we do a first racking. So it come from September to January without anything. Just fermentation, batonnage, on lees. Then we separate the big lees because we have the lees of fermentation at this time. We have the lees of fermentation. We separate the big lees from the wine, and then we finish the aging on fine lees back to the woods until next July. That means a small year. Then we do the final general blend and we do the bottling. So it's two rackings in its life.
You have Roussan in there, but it's mostly Claret.
45% Claret.
Little Grenache Blanc, little Beaublanc.
About 30% Grenache, and then the rest is Roussan and Beaublanc, yes.
So how does Roussan differ from a grape like Claret?
It's day and night. You have the Claret, which bring freshness, and its taste brings kind of gentleness, kind of teal taste, white flower, kind of life in the wine. But a lack of richness, lack of roundness, lack of potential. And the Grenache and the Roussan bring the honey taste, the richness, kind of velvety, kind of fatness in a good sense, kind of basement of the wine, but a lack of freshness, a lack of finesse, a lack of things. And when you put them together, it brings you the balance. And I think it was so well ordinated from the beginning when they created the appellation in 1936 or 1929, in between, they have decided to keep this different grapes together, like you have different tools in your garage to make the wine. You have different grapes, and you can have the freshness from the Claret, the freshness and this kind of gentleness from the Bourboulenc. You can have the richness from the Grenache, and you can have this kind of heaviness, this kind of real velvety from the Roussan. And then you manage in front of thinking in your palate, thinking in your terroir, in harmony of what you have in mind and what you are capable to do, because every terroir cannot ripe every grape. And then you make what you have in mind. And that's great. That was very, very intelligent at this age to let to the wine growers the possibility to do 100% Claret or 100% Roussan. That's... and of course, made a blend, but no rules in terms of proportion. We made an experimentation one day, that was 2002, a pure Roussan. It's an experimentation. We have a cuvée, it's called Hippolyte, and this Hippolyte is never sold, it's just for tasting and for experimentation. So in 2002, which was a very difficult Very difficult vintage in terms of red. We have made two experimentation. We have made a Claret 100% and a Roussanne 100%.
That sounds kind of fascinating to me. I mean, to see them. Yeah. You know, I know you said it's a palette and you get to try a lot of different things and it's different tools, but to see them that starkly different must be very interesting.
Come to see us and I will show you. And now we have 15 years old or 14 years old Claret and Roussanne pure.
In the bottle.
In the bottle. And honestly, they are great. Both of them are great. I prefer the Claret. But it can work by themselves. But honestly, to reach the balance, to reach something, let's say, in this old school of Châteauneuf du Pape White, it's, I think, a necessity to blend different grapes. If you want to make something a bit like a specific wine, a bit like a special cuvée, a bit like something, but not in the old school of Châteauneuf. Old school of Châteauneuf, for me, it's fresh, balanced, mineral, flowery. You can use for food, of course, for everything. You can drink it with chicken, with rabbits, with crabs, with lobsters, with asparagus, with tomatoes, gazpacho, olive oil. White Châteauneuf in an old school way is really a friend of food. It's much more easy to pair than a red Châteauneuf.
So when you made those single varietal whites, the Roussanne and the Claret, did they, and now it's 14 years old in bottle, did they go through the same aging curve as this?
Roussanne age a bit quicker. Roussanne has not the same freshness today as the Claret. But it's from Lacroix. Huh? It's an experience which is true only for us.
But did the Claret do that thing where it goes down and then comes back
no.
up? No. Okay.
That was strange.
Okay. That's what I'm
That's a
really
good question.
In.
No.
You know what I mean?
No, we didn't have this kind of gasol taste with the Claret. No more with the Roussanne.
Interesting. I mean, that's really
interesting.
Yeah, right?
That's a good question. I mean, it's and I have the question in my head now as you send me the question. No, we didn't have this kind of dumb period. Yeah, it could be. It's interesting. I'm sorry. I'm questioning myself, but it could be. It could be a kind of let's say adaptation between all the grapes, kind of mariage, consuming of the mariage after some years of the different grapes, which make this happen.
02 was a cold year, right?
02?
Yeah.
Was a specific year.
A lot of rain, right?
A lot of rain, yes.
Because I wonder in a warm year if it might be different. You know, if you did that in 03 with the separate...
You're right. But 02, before rains, we picked the grapes, white grapes, before the rains. It was very very strange because we picked the white grapes and then it rains and then everything changed. Because we got 400 millimeters in 24 hours. So it's like two-thirds of the rain from a full year so in 24 hours. So it's changed dramatically the things. Yes, but when we picked the white grapes, it was not the same feeling. Arriving to this date, it was a normal classic vintage. So we can say they are from a normal classic vintage.
So talk about a big change and a big departure. You also started working in Lebanon in the Bekaa.
Mm.
And what was that like? I mean, that's a very different elevation.
Yeah.
And some different grape varieties, although some are the same.
Yeah, of course, some are the same. We have imported with us, of course, our love and our passion for Rhone wines, Rhone grapes. And of course, the climate over there is really adapted to Rhone grapes. It's one of the best places of the world for the Senso. The Senso has a result in Lebanon like rarely everywhere. It's really, the better Senso I taste in my life was in Lebanon. pure senso. Yes, it's an adventure we began in 1998 when I met with a gentleman called Sammy Rosen. He came to Vieu Telegraph and was just like this, looking for partners to begin a winery, to build a winery, to begin a wine business in Beccar Valley. His family owned a small vineyard in the center of Beccar. It took for us some weeks to decide, and we said, why not? It's an adventure, human adventure. The guy become quickly friend of us with his brother, Ramsey. And we decided to join to the adventure with two guys from Bordeaux, Dominique Ebrard and Hubert Debois. And we began, and it's still a good, a great human adventure. So Hubert left. Now we are only Dominique, the Rosen brothers, and my brother and I. And it's a great adventure. Of course, we are not in the same climate, not the same altitude. The vines, the lowest vine we have is 900 meters above the sea level. But we are south, and it's because of this altitude that the balance can be joined, can be reached. So from 900 meters to 1100 meters above the sea level, we have our vineyards. It took a while to decide where to go in the valley, because the valley is big. The valley is easy to grow.
You didn't have a vineyard when you started the project?
No, not really. We bought a lot of grapes during years and years in different parts of the valley just to see what happened. And then we began to plant vines. It took some years because we have an experiment per year. So we have decided after years to develop our vineyard in the northeast of Beccar, on the Piedmont of Mont-Liban and Antiliban, the two sides of the Beccar, close to Syria, which is not the easiest place to grow, actually, because of the political environment. It's a specific country to work. It's very specific. You have to manage with this kind of things. But it's possible. I mean, it's not a problem. You can do it, etc. So we know what we want to grow. We know exactly the soil we want to grow. That was decided, let's say, about 10 years ago. And now, finally, the grapes from this place has arrived. So it's always a new start. So it's 98, it's 15 or things like this. Or a bit more than 15 years adventure. And we can say today it's a new start, because we know exactly where we go, because we know exactly what we can do, what kind of complexity we can achieve, what kind of minerality, what kind of saltiness we can get from the soil, what kind of wine we can make. So we are, as I told you, in a kind of new start, new life since 5-6 years. And in the meantime, we have decided to build a new winery. So the first winery, where we do mainly the reds, in the center of Beccar. And now we are in a process to achieve, it's really really finished since some months, a new winery in Mount Lebanon at 1,700 meters above the sea level, where we have the winery dedicated for the white wine, dedicated to restaurant business, to tasting, to this kind of social thing we need in Lebanon, to teach the people to bring this kind of spirit of wine. And we decided to build this winery because it's an environment which is great. Center of Beccar is nice, but it's not so easy to live. And with all the things happen in the last year and a half, is quite difficult to continue to live there. So we make the wine in that winery, but our activity, social reception, is made in Mount Lebanon, which is great. It gives us another picture. It gives us another face in front of the wine world. So it's good. It's another adventure.
After several decades at Vue Telegraph, Daniel Brunier is still looking for new adventures and fresh starts, even if they're quite difficult. Thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you very much for interviewing me.
Daniel Brunier of Vue Telegraph, Les Palières, and Messiah in Lebanon. Before we finish up this episode, we have some people to thank. A big thank you to the amazing Alder Yarrow and his website, vinography.com, where you can find write-ups and warm-ups for the show, as well as other exceptional content. A huge thank you also to Drew Hendricks and James Tidwell of Texom, who made a generous and really game-changing donation of new equipment to this show. You can check out texsom.com, that's TEXSOM.com, to see what they're up to in their own endeavor. It's always a pleasure also to be involved with Crush Wine and Spirits in Manhattan, with whom we have a wine club for regularly discounted offers on wines that we feature on this show. You can write to me directly at levyopenswine@gmail.com to find out how you can join in on our wine club. And also our thanks to you, the audience. Together, we get to really sit down and learn about wine one person at a time. You can let us know what you think on our Facebook page or by following us on Twitter at DrinkToThatPod. You can also check out pictures on Instagram at LevyOpensWine, that's me, or you can leave a comment and a review in iTunes. We love iTunes comments. They go a long way to help us out, too. Also, if you haven't subscribed to the show yet on iTunes, you should go ahead and hit that up. iTunes subscribers see new episodes in their feed before non-subscribers, and often new episodes arrive several hours or even days earlier for subscribers. If you want to listen to the newest episode of the show, and also if you want to listen to back episodes from when we first got started, the easiest way to do so is to subscribe in iTunes. Our website is alldrinktothatpod.com. That's alldrinktothatpod.com with no apostrophe in the ill. And you can find information there about buying a t-shirt to wear around so you can show your support, or also about how to donate to the show. There's some back episode listings on the website as well. We'll see you again next episode, and cheers.